You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com. You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
All right. Welcome to the Brews and Appraisal Views podcast, where non-lending appraisals meet humor and insight. I'm your host, Dan Lindemann, certified appraiser, serving the South Florida market for over 20 years. Each episode will blend interviews, tips, and stories to help you grow your private appraisal business. Whether you're a trainee, an established appraiser, or just curious about the field, this podcast is for you. So grab your favorite beverage, turn up the volume, and join us as we dive into this week's episode featuring Bar Ryan Jones, a real estate agent with Century 21 Stein Posner Realty. So appraisers, as you know, agents are an excellent referral source for non-lending appraisals. Referrals from agents account for about 20% of my personal business. They order pre-listing appraisals, appraisals for cash buyers, home measurements. They help with price reductions. So without further ado, I wanted to introduce you to Brian Jones. He's a realtor that I work with in my market for the past couple of years. So welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here. I'm glad you asked me to be on the show, and I look forward to sharing some of our insights and answering whatever questions you have.
Awesome. So tell us about yourself.
Well, I live in Coral Springs, Florida, which is a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. I've been a realtor for the past 20 years, so I was licensed in 2004. My early experience in real estate had me doing on-site sales, which essentially I was working for developers and selling pre-construction condos or condo conversions or single family homes. When that market, the condo market sort of dried up for us in 2007, I transitioned to doing the same type of work, but I was then doing it from Cancun, Mexico. When our market crashed, the stock market crashed in 2008, I was forced to come home and reinvent myself as a realtor. And I did so, and I've been doing that now here locally since 2009.
That's awesome. I didn't even know that. I guess I never got to know you really, Brian, at all. I never asked you these type of questions. So this is good. I'm glad you came on. So one thing I do know about you, you're a Badger.
I am.
So I know people from the Midwest love to drink, and the title of the podcast is Brews. I normally have a beer because it's late afternoon when I do these, but today I don't. So are you a beer drinker?
Well, being from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, aka Brew City, I have no choice but to be a beer drinker. My favorite drink is really an espresso martini. However, if you had to ask me what my favorite beer was, and I know it's going to sound gross, it's the beer that I'm most fond of from where I'm from, and that's PBR Me ASAP, Pabst Blue Ribbon. Ooh. Not a great taste, but certainly a nostalgic beer. I don't typically drink it here, but anytime I go home to Wisconsin, first beer I have is a PBR.
I will agree with you. I drink PBR. It's the cheapest 24-pack I think Publix sells, which is really good. And I like the taste. It's not bad. It's not bad at all.
That's not bad. Also, speaking of Wisconsin, if anybody wants to do some research, if you were to Google the top 20 drunkest cities in the United States, 13 of them would be in Wisconsin. So 65% of our top drunkest cities in the entire country are from my home state. Milwaukee ranking in the top four or five for sure.
I believe it. My best friend is from Wisconsin, brilliant, and he is a drinker for sure.
So it's a culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's a bad culture. It's just a socializer. So
it's a fun culture.
Everything to the extreme.
Exactly. The older I get, the harder it is to do it. But each and every time I go home, I end up with a PBR and hanging out with friends and having drinks. So it is what it is.
How old are you, Brian?
I am 52 years old.
Awesome. I'm 41.
You're 41. Youngster.
Yeah. And you don't have any kids?
I do not.
No kids.
Okay. No kids. Married, no kids. And once we decided not to have kids, we decided that we were going to be the best aunts and uncles we could possibly be. I also coach track in my free time, so I mentor kids and coach kids. So I get my dose of a lot of kids around me. I just get to send them home at the end of the day, and that works out well.
I would love to be in that position sometimes.
I hope they don't see this podcast.
Yeah, right. No, God, no. I sent it to them. They won't listen to this. Whatever. So what kind of volume do you close?
Ooh, that's a good question. Typically, on a typical year, I'll do about $10 million worth of business. This year, as we stand, I'm at $9 million, and I have projections to do $22 million worth of business this year. So
that's fantastic. So you're not a part-time agent. You don't just dabble in it. You're full-time.
No, and this year, more so than ever, I made a concerted effort to really be in the business. A lot of times I felt like, you know, I was waiting for my sphere of influence or my people to call me, and I would just do the work for them. Now I'm being a little bit more assertive, and I'm actually trying to go out and get more business. And as a result of that and showing up every single day and doing it, I've been able to generate a lot more business. It's caused, you know, it makes me busier and sometimes causes a little bit more stress in my life. But at the end of the day, I'd rather be productive and helping as many people as I possibly can. So going forward, that's the plan. I think, you know, this year will be 22, and we're going to try to build off of that by continuing marketing, continuing putting ourselves out there, and continuing putting a team around me to help leverage so I don't have to be like Superman and try to be everywhere for everybody.
Absolutely. I think that's the goal for every agent who wants to, you know, get is to get that team environment so it's not all on them. How many people are on your team now?
Well, are you included part of my team?
Sure, absolutely.
Perfect. Absolutely. I mean, so in all honesty, I mean, it's myself, and I have three other people that work with me. I also have a transaction coordinator who's based in the Philippines and does a lot of my paperwork and my contracts for me. But I do consider you a team member, Dan, because on just about every listing I go on, your name comes up. I sit down and talk with sellers and tell them that I want to bring you in to help evaluate the price. The reason behind that really is I have an idea of what I think the price is or the value of the property is. And oftentimes, sellers have an inflated view of what their house might be worth, whether it's what their neighbor sold it for a couple of years ago or what they see on Zillow, Realtor.com, or Redfin. So I try to get clarity by having you come in. In addition, I've got a inspector that I use on a regular basis, and then I use the same title company, JK Closings, and I've been using them exclusively for the past 15 years. So those are really, you know, the hallmarks and the people I rely on the heaviest in my business.
Awesome.
And you're a part of that group.
I appreciate it. That's great. Mm-hmm. I'm glad love to be part of. I love being part of the team. So when you, I know we've been working together for a couple of years. How did you find me, and how and why did you start doing these pre-listing appraisals?
You just, you know, you're pretty good at sending out email blasts, right? Empire Closings will help you with your solar panel issues. Empire Closings, whatever, or M Closings, Empire Appraisals.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had seen those several times, and one time I opened them up and I was thinking I'd taken two probate listings in Fort Lauderdale. This is really how you and I met for the first time. And they were Section 8, and I felt like they were dilapidated. They had tenants in them, and I didn't know how to properly price them just based on overall condition, based on location. They were really outside of the areas that I typically work in. So I wanted you to be able to come in to give me an idea of where I should list these properties. I didn't want to overlist them and then have them sit, and I certainly didn't want to underlist them. So I brought you in, and you were a guiding light. You gave me a price range to work within. We utilized that price range, and in all honesty, I sold both those houses in 2 days with
excellent,
you know, hundreds of showings. So, you know, it made me a believer in what you were doing. And I figured, why not do this going forward? Because, you know, any of us as agents can create a CMA. But I don't always know how to make the calculations. And I think that's what you're able to do, right? I'm not a licensed appraiser. So I don't know necessarily how to make square footage adjustments, whether it be for lot size or whether it be for interior space. I don't know how to, you know, make an adjustment for if it's a three bedroom or a four bedroom, or it's a three and a den, but it could be a bedroom. Or on the deal we worked on just yesterday or a couple of days ago in Coral Springs, you know, where there was my listing doesn't have a pool. And when I saw your adjustments, you did $60,000 for a pool on one and then $50,000 for a pool on another. And I asked you to help me understand what the difference was. And you just said one of them has a spa or a hot tub. So I don't necessarily know how to make those adjustments. And I really want to be as close as I can to value so I can get the sellers on the right path to having a successful experience with me. If we overlist, we're going to lag on the market and lose leverage, and we'll ultimately have to reduce the price to what it should have been had I gotten it appraised up front.
Yeah, and you initially get, and then you get those offers that are initially lower than they would have been initially if you priced it correctly.
Correct.
So you think that's the biggest advantage of getting a pre-listing appraisal is knowing what the price is and at least having that locked in.
Well, it's two things. It's knowing it, and then it really is helping the seller get clarity, right? In our business, it seems more often than not, the seller that wants to sell their house typically wants more than they think it's worth. So even if I list it at what I think it's worth at my CMA, they think I'm giving the house away. And yet when I work with that same seller as a buyer, they see a house that's probably priced properly, and they think it's priced way too high. So it's just trying to get them on the right page to do what's best for them. And for me, it's always, the conversation is really always, you know, I want to look at the value of your property through the eyes of an appraiser who does this. You're super credible. You're super friendly when you show up at the house, and you've been doing this for 20 years. So I don't want to make a guess, or I don't want to let the seller necessarily lead the way, because it's going to set us up for an outcome that we ultimately don't want. And if the goal is to sell the house and sell it for the highest price possible, why not price it right to begin with and give yourself an opportunity to have multiple offers, which gives you as a seller leverage, as opposed to me overlisting it and then us having no leverage because we've been on the market 120 days. That's really
what it comes exactly. Out. And what is the, are there any disadvantages to getting a pre-listing appraisal?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, some of the hardship is when I think it's worth something, the seller thinks it's worth something, and Dan thinks it's worth, you know, worth less, then, you know, suddenly I'm the bad guy for bringing Dan in, and we've got to re-go over the numbers with the seller to try to make it make sense. And, you know, you and I have had that happen before. We did that with that house in Sunrise. You appraised it at 640. The sellers weren't excited. We listed it at 659.9, and guess what? It sold in 2 days for 69.9, and it appraised. So, you know, when I look at it, I have to remind the sellers that oftentimes you're going out and, you know, your people can correct me if I'm wrong. This is the way I look at it. But oftentimes you're going out for me and you're just trying to find the value based on the comps in the neighborhood, right? You have no price to go after, right. Nothing. In the case of the Sunrise house, same condition, same everything. And we were able to get 659, but I think that appraiser went out thinking, hey, you know, I've got a price here of 659. Can I make this price make sense? If I had it at 640, it may have appraised at 640. And I had it at 650, it may have appraised at 650. We had it at 659 and it appraised. I used the same exact comps you used as well.
Sure. And you know what? So when you know the sale price, you're kind of, even though you're unbiased, it's still a bias in the back of your mind. You know what that price was. Mm-hmm. And it's another piece of data at the end of the day. Like if your property down there had, you know, 20 showings and five offers all around 660 or whatever was that, you know, the market may be screaming that it's 660. And so that's also a piece of data too, that appraisers mm-hmm. rely on, like, not like anchoring their value to the contract, but it's still a fact. It's still a piece of evidence that we need to consider. So that could be why.
Right. So, and it wasn't a wild swing. It's not like I'm saying, hey, I got, you know, 740 for it. What the heck happened with your appraisal, Dan? No, I mean, it's a close number. It's close.
Oh, yeah. If I'm within a few percent, I'm real happy. That's why I give right. a range of value. Like, yep. What the hell do I know? I right. don't know what the buyers are going to do. It's between these two numbers.
Yep. Totally agree.
So,
totally agree. You know, and the other, you know, that was a success story, but you also did an appraisal for me and it was a little 55 plus community. We came in and you said it was 215 and the seller insisted on listing it for 255. Then it expired.
How did that work out?
Yeah, it expired after 6 months and I took the listing again, but she never really wanted to come down. And the deal ultimately expired just a few days ago. And she texted me today, these realtors won't stop calling me. Of course, they're not going to stop calling you, but no one can sell your house at 255. It's just, it's not happening. The value's not there. We did multiple progressive open houses. So, you know, on a typical Saturday or Sunday, I would contact several agents in that same community, and we'd have one giant open house from like 12 to 3. And there's six properties that are having the open house. Five of those properties sold, my number sold, and all of them sold for well below 255. So that was the litmus test for me. And I realized that since the seller was going to be inflexible with the price, there wasn't really any need for us to put forth any more effort at open houses or anything, unless it was to generate potential buyer leads, which I didn't want to do that either. So
for that market, 55 and other buyers. I'm sure that's a great market for you.
I'm not going to miss a football Sunday or Saturday to hang out over there. Especially if I don't have to.
So that's a huge, when you don't price it properly, it just costs you time and money taking on those listings. I don't know why agents do it. They just promise these sellers ridiculous numbers and it wastes their time and wastes their money. I don't know why they do it and hurts their reputation.
That's what it is. And at the end of the day, this is a people business disguised as real estate, disguised as appraising. But, referrals are important to us. Our reputation is important to us. So if we're out here over-promising and under-delivering, chances are we're not going to be able to close that transaction. And as a result, we're not going to get a good review from that person, but yet we could get a negative review from the person. We're certainly not going to get any type of referrals from them because, hey, I showed up and I struck out and I said we were going to sell it and we didn't sell it. Don't use Brian. He's a terrible agent. So not worth it at the end of the day. Ooh, I can't hear you, Dan.
All right, Brian, we're back. Sorry about that little malfunction.
It happens. No worries.
Best part about being an agent. What do you got?
For me, it's, you know, on the surface, it's the flexibility of schedule, right? I haven't worked in an office environment or outside of real estate in over 20 years. And the last time I had to go to any office on a regular basis, like a daily basis, was probably in 2008. So that to me is huge. I have a lot of flexibility. But really the best part of my business is being, and it sounds cliche, but it's being able to help people achieve their goals for real estate, whether it's buying the perfect dream house, buying a second house, or selling their home and moving on with their lives. I enjoy the process in many ways, and, you know, pardon the pun here, but it's like, pardon the analogy, I should say, it's, you know, like my job feels like an episode of The Love Boat, right? The Love Boat, Doc was there, Captain Steubing, Julie was there, Isaac was there, everybody was there every week, every episode. It was a new cast of characters. And oftentimes that's the way my business is. You go all in with your...
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call. Because real protection means showing up. Even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Clients and you work with them. If you do it right, you're working with them for a good 30 to 60 days, and then they're off somewhere else. You stay in touch with them, you know, keep in touch with them, wish them happy birthday, do everything you have to do to maintain the relationship. But the people come and the people go. And in our business, I've always felt like the buyers come and the buyers go, but everyone else remains the same. You're still dealing with the same agents on the other side of transactions. You're dealing with the same appraisers, the same title companies, same inspectors, same everything else. But for me, it really is totally about the relationships, having these great relationships, meeting people you typically would just walk past at the grocery store or walk past on the street and getting to know them. And, you know, let's not forget, this is a very personal business as well. You're dealing with high emotions for people moving for whatever reason. It's emotional, especially if they've been in their house for a long time or they're leaving or life has changed and forced them to leave. So, you know, it really is about the relationships and getting to know people. And again, trying to do what they've hired me to do, but doing so in a way that's fully transparent and doing so in a way that really exceeds their expectations.
That's cool. It's kind of like you're their best friend for 3 months when you take on it, and then they move on. Yep. You move on to the next one. It's like you're making new best friends every time all you sign a listing agreement. Yeah, that's kind of cool. On the flip side, what's the hardest part of the job?
The hardest part is you know, the schedule as well. It's a typical work day for me starts at, I would say, 7:30 in the morning, and that's you know, I wake up at 6, but I'll exercise and have a coffee and just try to get into my groove and get into my day. But at any given time, you know, I am a slave, if you will, to my transactions, my deal management, and then to all of my clients. And if I don't have the proper or the necessary leverage around me, I find days spinning out of control where I thought I was going to go into a day and do A, B, and C. Something has come up and dragged me somewhere else. And then the typical day really doesn't end until maybe midnight. I'm working on something one way or another. And sometimes just due to everything that I have to do during the typical work day, I don't get a chance to do some of the things that I need to do on the computer until 1 or 2 in the morning. So oftentimes I find myself tired or not sleeping as much as I should. But again, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't want to go to a cubicle type job. You know, and another advantage of this is really a unlimited income opportunity, right? And I won't say
sure.
It's unlimited.
You're not capped. Yeah, you're not capped. Yeah.
I'm not capped. I get what I work for, and I go into it with the understanding of, you know, we don't, as realtors, we don't get paid unless the transaction actually closes. You know, I suppose somebody could argue if there's a retained deposit, you make money off of that. But our goal isn't that. Our goal is to close properties, sell properties. So in the penalty of cases, you can do all of the right things and do all of the work, but not have a successful closing, and then there's no money there. So, but I like the fact that I can get paid for as hard as I want to work.
That's cool. All right. So back to appraisers. Any bad experiences or any challenges with appraisals? What's been your biggest roadblock? Anything with appraising?
Again, when I was a new agent, I didn't necessarily know how to approach an appraiser. Like when I show up for every appraisal on my listings, first and foremost, right? I want to control the narrative there. I typically want to provide comps without being offensive to anybody, but I want to give a little bit of guidance to help them understand how we justified the price or what our mindset was, and to highlight some comps that I think are beneficial, but not completely out of the box. Like if I have a 3-bedroom that I'm selling, I'm not going to bring a comp of a 5-bedroom, like that doesn't make sense. I want to offer as few adjustments as possible. But I've had properties that haven't appraised before, but at the end of the day, I've never really had any issue with any appraisers. I think once back in 2016, I had a house in Fox Ridge in Parkland. We had it listed at 750. We got it under contract at 750, and I brought comps that I wanted the appraiser to consider. And as I was meeting him, he held up his hands. He's like, "Hey, you can't give me those. You could be arrested for giving me comps," which totally blew me in. I know what that meant. And then he went on to tell me, you know, his history, and he's on the board of appraisers here, and he's been doing this forever. And, you know, so it kind of set the tone for what I thought was going to be a terrible appraisal. It turned out to be a terrible appraisal. The house appraised at $699. So after some back and forth with the seller was a seller who needed to move and didn't necessarily, wasn't really searching for the best price. He needed to get on with his life. So after about 24 hours, the seller said, "Okay, I'll go with the appraised price of $699," and then the buyer walked away anyway. And then it took us another month to sell his house for $675. I've tried in the past to contest an appraisal. It typically doesn't work. I just find it to be a waste of time. So I don't know what your experience is with that. I don't know. I've never had a successful contested appraisal.
Well, one, let's go back to what to bring to the appraisal. When I do agent trainings at offices, I tell them, you know, bring like 3 to 5 sales, bring a list of all the updates, bring any surveys or anything like that. Yeah, bring as much information as possible. As appraisers, we can take whatever information. You just can't try and influence the appraisal. That's the only thing. And sales are not influence. You discussing how you price the property is data, and we need to consider that. So it's not, you weren't doing anything wrong by showing the appraiser sales from the neighborhood. That is a very ignorant appraiser. He needs to, or he or she needs to accept, you know, just accept the data and not just Right. And then let them interpret it themselves. You know, if it's all junk, like if you pulled up the five highest price sales prices in the neighborhood and just gave that to the appraiser, I could see that. And I would just disregard that information. It's like, hey, this agent just anchored it to a price and that's all they care about. You know,
exactly.
The most similar sales will always speak for themselves. So right. That's good. You go to every appraisal.
It's my job to do that, right? I've got to be there to defend what the sales price is and try to get it. Another thing, it's part of the packages that I bring when I'm bringing a couple of comps with me. Typically, it's 3 to 4 or 5, whatever I have that I feel is relevant. But I'm also, you know, on BCPA, you can print out like the sketch of the property. So I'm always doing that because, you know, our MLS isn't always accurate and it'll show a house that's 3,200 square feet. But then as you pull the print or the sketch, you see, well, you know, it's really only 2650 and the numbers are here. So a lot of times people get caught up. It's more so in condo, but in price per square foot, I just want the appraiser to see that we've looked at that to make sure that the square footage is actually right.
Yeah. And that's a big one. We're supposed to, on these lending assignments, we're supposed to measure the property. So we're not supposed to go by the county sketch. We're supposed to take our own measurements and we have a certain standard we need to follow now. So we're supposed to be doing that. So
perfect.
All right. So as far as appeals go, like doing a challenge to an appraisal, there's new ROV policy now where borrowers, if they think the appraisal is low for some reason or has errors, they can submit an appeal now. There's a formalized process that Fannie and Freddie just went through and are doing. So it's just one more thing if there's an error in their appraisal. I'll be honest, there's probably an error in every single one of my appraisals. Probably you were talking about pool and spa, 50, 60K. I probably forgot to leave off spa from the description or it could have been an error. Like sure, I make errors. I'm not perfect. But so in an appeal, you're right. It's tough to get an appeal done because appraisers don't like to admit they're wrong ever.
Correct.
And they'll fight you tooth and nail.
Correct.
So you're right. If somebody says they want to challenge an appraisal, if it's an FHA, I tell them you probably need to have the case number reassigned or a new case number for that property. Yeah. Or switch lenders. That's really all you can do if the appraiser is not going to budge on the number, you know, if they won't admit any errors.
Right. And you're calling, I felt like when you try to contest, you're really calling their professionalism or their judgment or their skill set into question. And when people do that to you, no matter what your profession is, you're going to dig your heels in a little bit and justify your price or justify whatever they're trying to do. So I try not to do it. I try to do everything I can to get it to appraise. But it's not foolproof. Like the value is going to be what the value is. I just do my best to try to make it happen.
All right. So what's the most unusual thing you've seen at a property or have seen a homeowner do?
You have any examples of like what you're looking for? I mean, I've seen tons
just
of
some weird stuff
on a, you know, tons
I've seen
of
weird group. Things at people's homes, people acting strange. I've seen a lot of, I've seen drugs on a table. I've seen naked people. I've seen a lot of different stuff.
I've walked into a house and I felt like it was like, you know, the van episode in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, if I'm dating myself, but Spicoli comes out of the van. There's like a cloud of smoke. I had to show a house like that one day, which was pretty wild. I've walked in on people doing things they shouldn't have been doing when showings were going on in a house. I walked into a house and went in the backyard. There was a naked pool party going on that no one bothered to tell anybody about. I also saw a house that had a half a tiger in it. So it was like a taxiderm tiger and maybe they got it at a discount or something. I have no clue, but it was like a half a tiger. So since they didn't have the other half, they just pushed him up against the wall and it looked like he was creeping out of the wall on you. And then of course, you know, you always see rooms that shouldn't be there and whatnot. So, you know,
those improvements people make.
Yeah, hey, this is our ninth bedroom in the house, dude. You know, like, what? Where is this thing? So,
people do some weird stuff.
Yeah. And I've also had sellers who, you know, on my listings, I show all of my listings, right? I personally show them. I have like a no lockbox guarantee, unless it's just some vacant condo or whatever, but I personally show them. And I've had sellers who, you know, refuse to leave or don't want to leave and just want to sit on the couch and be a part of the presentation. And that rarely goes well, you know,
I agree.
Those houses become a little bit tougher to sell when the seller won't get out of the house or wants to walk around and tell them everything. And I start to wonder, why'd you even hire me? This is what I'm here to do. Like, go hang out somewhere, dude.
So we just went to an open house in our neighborhood last weekend. Not that we weren't moving, but just to look at the house. The agent was there and the homeowner was there walking us around the house. I'm like, why is this happening right now? I can't even be honest with an agent or ask anything. Exactly. This is the worst experience when a homeowner's at a house and you're showing it.
So true.
Yeah.
So true. And it's super, you're right. You can't be honest. And that's what it comes down to. Right.
Yeah. So when I do the pre-listing stuff and these people have like big dogs and stuff, I literally coach them. I'm like, please tell me you're going to remove the dogs for these showings. The dogs cannot be anywhere in the property. Nobody wants barking dogs in a room caged up or anything. That's the worst experience going as well.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I mean, yeah, I'm going to go show a house and potentially get bit by a dog. Not happening.
Yeah, I agree. So, all right, if you're at a house waiting for the appraiser and the appraiser's walking up, is there some sort of theme music that plays in your mind, like as they walk up? Because sometimes it plays in my mind when I see it, like walking up to an agent or something. It's just like, I don't know, just like a beat or something, or
it's funny. I feel like the Rocky theme goes on in my head, and it's just an instrumental, right? But it really is like the moment of truth. This is where we're going to understand the value of this property. Typically, and you know how the process works, we get the house under contract, right? We go through inspections. We fight through whatever negotiations there are there. And then next up is really the final countdown right here. Boom. If we can make this number work, it's great. If not, there's a potential for the buyer to walk away or a new negotiation. So when I hear it, it's like the Rocky theme song. And I know this is really typically the last hurdle that I have to clear in protecting the seller as best I can. Doesn't mean the buyer can suddenly lose their job and the deal falls apart, but it means that this is the last phase of the fight.
The last big straw. Yeah.
The bet. That's it.
All right, cool. We're not going to talk about the settlement with the Sitzer Burnett thing. I could probably talk like 30 minutes on that whole cooperating agent commission structure. But I did have one last question. I'm going to pop up on the screen. Reading through Men's Health last month, this article comes up talking about appraisal bias.
Yep.
Is this a problem in our market? Have you seen it? What's your take on it?
Great question. First of all, those people look pretty similar to me. The house looks a little bit different. But I have heard of appraisal bias. I've read some articles on it. I have personally never experienced it. And, you know, while it's easy to look at a picture like this and make assumptions. One, we're making an assumption about the appraiser, him or herself. But, you know, there could be a justification why these prices are different, right? Like, were they taken at the same time? How close were these appraisals? What was the condition of the house or the property at the time of appraisal? What other new comps came into the market at the time of an appraisal? So it's easy to have like a knee-jerk reaction and say, oh, well, the people on the right, they look a little bit different. So the person, you know, so they got a lower appraisal. Could this exist? Does bias exist? I'm sure it does, or could, but we're really looking at numbers here. Like, this is a numbers game for you guys, right? You're looking at comparable sales, not numbers. People that live in the house.
And correct. Oh, so I'm sorry for the listeners. No. But I put up an image on there. It shows home appraisals should not be based on the home appraisal should be based on property, not people. You have two couples there with houses behind them. One couple's got $380,000 below them, and the couple next to them has $475,000 under them. So the goal of this ad is to make it seem like appraisers are valuing property based on people, not the property. So that's what we're talking about here.
Could it exist?
I'm sure bias.
Does it? I mean, I've never experienced it myself.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say it doesn't. I just haven't experienced it.
Me personally, like, I couldn't imagine risking my license, which is the potential to earn millions and millions of dollars, and come in with an appraisal because of the way somebody looks. That doesn't even, I wouldn't risk that or risk my family.
Nope.
It just to hurt an appraisal. That doesn't, I'm sure obviously there's a reason this is out here or this narrative. I don't know it, but I haven't seen it in my market. I haven't heard calls about it, but it's just another issue out there. So
I agree. I mean, look, it could it happen? Yes. Personally, I've never experienced it, and I'd hope it's a numbers game. You know what I mean? Like we said, you could send three appraisers out to the same house and get three different values. The swing on this for the type of house, I mean, it's like a huge difference. So,
sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, and I don't even know the color of the people. If I'm doing a sale, sometimes the seller's not even there. How would I even know what color they are?
Correct.
That doesn't make any sense. All right. All right, I just wanted to bring that up because it's been in the forums and stuff around there. So, Brian, thank you very much for joining me today. But please hang around; we've got a few more questions just for our elite members. So just hang on the line for me, Brian.
I sure will. Thanks for having me. Have a great day, everybody.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.